The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
Delighted to say that Rassie Erasmus is joining the online business leadership event, Leaders Lounge. Now, Leaders Lounge is an online interactive event designed for CEOs, for senior management professionals, business executives, and those in wider leadership startup and coaching roles. It's focused on the themes inspirational, situational, and transformational leadership, and attendees will gain unique insights from an incredible panel of guests, including Rassie himself, from Brian O'Driscoll as well, Lady Chanel McCoy, Joanne O'Riordan is going to be there, and of course, resident host Paul McGinley. For further information or to purchase tickets for this event, which takes place later this month, you can visit www.leadersloungelive.com. Rassie Erasmus, how are you? Good morning.
Morning, Owen. I'm good, thank you. It's great to chat. It's great to hear that accent again. I'm not so sure if you can still understand my accent, but I'm sure you'll get used to it. No, it's awesome to talk to you guys. And when I spoke to Paul, to Paul and to all the other guys, it's exciting times. And Miss Ireland, big time. And it's nice to hear you guys' voices again.
How has the last year been for you, obviously, with the pandemic and with, obviously, sport being taken away from you? Has it been a bit of a struggle or have you been okay?
No, well, I think in South Africa, it's a bit different to how it is in Ireland and the rest of the world. We have got a population of 60 million people, so we were a bit nervous and we've got different lockdown levels and stuff like you had. There's been a lot of people who lost their lives and certainly in our rugby community, there's a lot of friends that passed away and that were really ill. Most of us had COVID and came through okay. But yes, it definitely influenced everything, your state of mind, the positivity. It was tough times, but I think the nice thing is the whole world are starting to stand together and try to make things work. I'm just in the rugby fraternity, how people are trying to get tournaments going without crowds. I think it shows that we can do things if we really rock bottom and we have to find ways, which is a positive.
It definitely feels that way with the Lions tour at the moment, that maybe 2 months ago it felt that this thing was in a bit of jeopardy, whereas every week now there's a more positive story about this being a real proper Lions tour in South Africa this summer.
Yeah, it's great. Look, I must be honest with you. We were willing to play in Ireland, in Twickenham. We just wanted to, because for us, it's just a massive thing. I played my first game for South Africa against the Lions. And it's just unique. If it was played there, it would have still been unique. It would have been once in a lifetime that it would be played at home for the Lions. But having it here, obviously, is first prize. We're working really hard to try and see if we can get crowds in. But if we don't get crowds in, we've seen, you look at the Six Nations games, it was still exciting. It was still the end. You don't know who's winning. So, it's awesome that we're getting closer and closer and it's becoming a reality.
When you look at the Six Nations over the past few weeks, do you see anything there in the British teams or in the Irish team that would worry you from a South African standpoint?
We definitely always worry. Look, when you put those nations together and you take the best of them, I mean, just playing against them individually, us having Scotland and Ireland in the World Cup in France is already, people talk about tough pools. Look what Scotland did in the Six Nations. Look what Ireland did. I mean, our World Cup pool is going to be really tough. And then you combine them now with England. And I know Wales is a really tough team. We had them in the semi-final. And we've been struggling the last couple of years. So if Warren gets his team selection right, and which he most of the time does, we're in for a tough time.
on the subject of the Six Nations, how long and hard did you have to think about potentially linking up with the Six Nations? I'm sure you were central to the thought process behind that. It looks like it's not going to happen now. But this idea of South Africa coming up and making it a Seven Nations, how close did that come to happening in your view?
I don't think I should comment on that one because, there's so many decision makers and processes that follow there. And, we've got such a long-standing relationship with the Sunzar, Argentina, and New Zealand and Australia. And we're still playing the rugby championships, So we did move now to Pro 16 and Rainbow Cup, they call it, as this interim competition, but hopefully Pro 16 from September, October this year. So that our club side, our provincial side, we're fully up north now, but we still, you know, 100% committed to the Sanlar deal. And, you know, you never know in future, you never know how things pan out. It's certainly really more convenient for our viewers and for our players to travel with the same time zones and watch games at times that you, not in the morning at 7 or at 9, you know, we can actually have a beer, enjoy the game. It's in the afternoon or the evening. So that's nice in the club and provincial side. But I don't have the info on where they are with the Six Nations and stuff like that.
That's totally fair. On those provincial teams then, how beneficial will that be from your standpoint, that the fact that there will be this, I don't know, Northern Hemisphere culture or that approach to games being brought into South Africa while at the same time being able to play the All Blacks? I guess it is a brilliant way to be able to broaden your horizons and ensure that you've got an idea of what's going on in the world game.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think one of the positive spin-offs is definitely, you know, that Super Rugby is an awesome competition. And we've been, I played in the first one back in 1994. I think they called it Super 10 still then. And it's an awesome competition. Now, the players you play against, the individual talent, the X factor is just amazing. But then you get to you finish Super Rugby, and then you get the autumn or the incoming tours in June to us. Then you play, you know, against Northern Hemisphere teams, who's normally at the end of their season, you know, in June after their Pro 16 or Premiership or whatever the case may be. And then, you know, they are a bit tired and we're just getting up. And then normally we'll play the Rugby Championships, and then we'll tour the end of year tour in November or in your autumn series. And then we are a bit tired and flat, and you guys are in the middle of your season. So I think the thing that works out for us here is that, you know, law interpretations, you know, the trends that are happening in the Northern Hemisphere, we'll experience that now in club rugby, in franchise rugby. So that's a positive. But we'll still have that flavor of the Sanlar way, you know, the X factor, that fast running rugby, which New Zealand and Australia and Argentina now also give. So, yeah, I think we've got a bit of both worlds, but both those worlds are going to be tough. It's going to be tough.
You mentioned there that quite often from the Northern Hemisphere standpoint, the teams from the Southern Hemisphere come up in the autumn. They're a little bit tired, perhaps don't put in as great a performance as they might want. And one of those moments, I think you'll agree, was 2017 when Ireland hammered South Africa. I think it was the last time Ireland played South Africa. I remember you saying at the time that that was the night where you decided, I have to go and I have to go to South Africa and try and help them. From the outside looking in, it seems like job done. You know, winning a World Cup 2 years later, that is the turnaround complete. But is it job done? Is it still a work in progress?
No, the job is far from done. Just to clarify that, because I think it came across the wrong way there in terms of it was decided that was actually our last day at work for Munster when right. We watched that. So it was already settled that we're coming back. You know, the IRFU was really good to me. David Nisifora was really good to me. Our CEO, who's now passed away at Munster, he was awesome in giving me the chance to go back and be the director of rugby of the South Africa, not the head coach. But when we were sitting there, we were sitting between the fans, and what we actually said to each other, which I think came across on the program, Chasing the Sun. I don't know who's watched that, but I think it came across that we said, this is the day where we want to go back and help South Africa. And what we actually said there is, we must never forget the people's faces, because we were sitting between South African fans at the Aviva, and it was just, they were just dumbstruck. It was just quiet. And so we actually just said, listen, okay, this must never happen again, if you understand. Sure. And that's on the day that we decided we're going back. So, yeah, that was a good experience to remember their faces and the shock in their faces, because you don't see that when you're on the field. And no, job's not done. We won the World Cup. We know we could have lost against Wales. We lost against the All Blacks in the first pool game. I think when you do what the All Blacks has done over the last 12 years, winning World Cups and consistently being number one, that's what we're striving towards. But we haven't played a game, we've got a lot to do.
That idea of peaking at the World Cup is something that's really interesting to the Irish audience, obviously. It seems to be the moment when Ireland are at their lowest ebbs sometimes and when the stakes are at their highest. You mentioned the Chasing the Sun documentary. The big line from an Irish standpoint that came out from the Chasing the Sun documentary was before the Wales game, when you said that they're not softies, they're not like Ireland, which, to be fair, I don't think too many people in Ireland would disagree with you in the context of the World Cup, that sometimes maybe a bit of Irish softness does come through every 4 years.
Oh, I would actually disagree with that. And I don't want to try and if people made up their opinion on what they've heard there, then you know I wouldn't try and convince them otherwise. But I think the people from Ireland who do know me know that I will never say something like that in a way that I'm meant to be negative, because what Irish people has done for me, what I've learned from Munster and Irish people overall in those 18 months were, I mean, I wouldn't have been the coach or half as successful. Not that I am really successful, but I mean, I would have been half as successful. Just to give context to that, you know, maybe it helps for those who's a little bit upset with me. We were actually talking about the different souls of a different team. The French got a different soul, the way they operate, you know, the England's got a different soul. And we were actually talking about Ireland, and we said they are so well drilled and say they're so clinical, and we've coached there. These guys, you know, they absolutely take ownership of the game. They will know exactly where to clean, when to clean. They're on top of their game. And we actually were going through all the team's souls, and I said they are not like Ireland, meaning they are this structured team that build phases and phases and phases. And then I said they are not softies. And I actually was talking about another team, which people can make up their mind what they. So, you know, I know Ireland's not softies. They beat us 39-0. So how can they be softies a year later? So, no, you know, I rate Ireland. I've coached there. For me, the big thing that stands out there is, which I tried to apply here and which helped a little bit, is the fact that they have 160 professional players, man. And I think that's tough to peak in a World Cup year. Because, you know, you get five or six guys who lose form or, you know, who gets injured, and all of a sudden you have the four scrum-offs at the four clubs, Munster and Leinster and so on. And all of a sudden now the other guy is just a new young guy who must now make it, and that might be in the World Cup year. So I just think their lack of numbers is really tough to make sure the right guys peak in that. But I mean, Andy and the boys will sort it out. I mean, he's been there with Joe for a while.
And the signs are encouraging after the end of this year's Six Nations, for sure. That lack of numbers is really interesting. Was that something that you saw in microcosm during your time at Munster, that perhaps the playing group that was going to come through within the province maybe wasn't strong enough to win a European Cup, for example?
No, I actually thought the playing group that came through there was the Coombs and those guys were the young guys when I was there. They're actually playing now, Gavin Coombs and those guys. Those were the academy boys when I was there. And you could see these guys were hell of a talented. And it was, for me, unbelievable how easy. It's actually, in South Africa, if you're a professional rugby player, and we had 1,100 at one stage, you know, who's professional, that's your job. And I was so surprised with the Irish setup, where you've got so many in academy, and then if you don't make it in academy, you go back to studying a teacher or normal day job. And the weirdest thing was, the players wasn't upset when you told them, listen, you're not going to be a professional rugby player. In South Africa, or my previous experience, even myself as a player, you know, it's a massive thing when somebody tells you you're not getting a contract, you're not going to be a professional rugby player. I mean, your whole world fall apart. And for me, the Irish people took it so professional, players specifically. You know, it would have been a function, say goodbye to the guy, a few tears shed, and he goes on with his life. You know, that was amazing for me. But I did feel the players are of a great standard, but I felt the numbers were lacking, especially because they were playing. I'm not just talking about Munster. I'm talking, Leinster obviously has loads and loads and loads of players. But I mean, for Ireland, you know, if they don't pick players from abroad, I thought there might be times that they struggle just because of the amount of players in Ireland. But David has done a great job in creating depth and switching players from province to province.
Outside of switching players from province to province, is there a fix that can see that playing pool swell over the next few years from your experience?
Well, you know, I don't want to give advice or make me sound clever on a terrain that I'm not involved anymore. Because, I mean, look at what they did in the Six Nations currently. You know, and I think apart from Munster, or how they played the weekend, I just think there's something there between Munster and Leinster. I never beat Leinster. I think we played them four times, beat them at Thomond, but we never beat them at Aviva or the RAS. I don't know how you're going to create your squad depth if you only have the four provinces. But maybe selecting guys who are playing overseas. I don't know if that's an option. I'm not saying they should. David, sure. Mustn't say Rassi must stay out of my business. You're just asking me, and I'm thinking, yeah. I don't know of another option.
No, that's fair enough. Like, I mean, that conversation around overseas players always comes up, especially when a bad result happens here or there in the Six Nations. One of the things that obviously you did very successfully, and they're continuing to do very successfully at Munster at the moment, it seems, is to recruit from abroad. And the South African tint to Munster, Snyman, of course, is injured at the moment, and hopefully we'll see more of him next season. Damien De Allende has been good, and of course, there's CJ Stander. That is the other way to help the standards rise in Munster, is to get these top-class players from abroad.
Yes, it is. I think the bad thing, there's good and bad of it all over the world in the different leagues. And I think the French is starting to get it right in the top 14, where they limit the amount of players that goes to a province. And I know David also, you know, if you want to get a foreign player in, you know, that's a hell of a process to do that. And just on that, you know, for example, in South Africa, in 14 provinces, I think there's two foreign players that plays. So, and there's about 450 players that plays abroad. So, I don't think it's a great thing for your competition, if for your national team, when, let's say, out of the lock positions, out of the four provinces, you know, three locks, Fadi, Argie Snyman, Jean Clint can qualify now, so he's Irish, but Argie can't qualify, and I think you signed Jason Jenkins now. Yeah. So out of one of your best provinces, three of the lock positions are taken up already. And I think that will also smaller in your pool, make your pool a little bit, but it will strengthen your club. It will definitely strengthen your club, you know. So it's a difficult one to balance. And I think the French are starting to get it right.
Yeah, it is a balance, isn't it? Because it does seem that the standard can be, I guess, it can be like osmosis within the setup, that somebody's playing beside CJ Stander. Of course, they're going to get better. And of course, when he becomes a test player, it's amazing. I guess the most traumatic moment of your time at Munster, I mean, how you can even begin to describe what would have happened after Axel's passing away so soon into your tenure as somebody involved with Munster Rugby. Growing as a leader, growing as a man, how did that awful, awful moment impact you in your growth as an individual?
No, apart from Axel, I must thank Munster and the Irish people for a hell of a lot of things. But the Axel passing away itself was just, you know, in South Africa, somebody passed away, you know, it's definitely sad, and but you go and you do, and you bury the person, and it's a service, and you know, and you must try to go on with your life. And I've never experienced how we had to get him back, obviously, from France, you know, and from him driving there, and the people, the locals there in the village next to the road, and then the church service, and then at his house. And I remember all of us, you know, getting together in the pub there, and then the actual, you know, funeral. And then after that, for me, it was difficult to handle, but it was almost this warm feeling I was getting of these people are sad, and I'm also sad, but it's almost this, let's celebrate it, man. And he gave me a total different outlook on how you should see when people pass away, and it's not the same in South Africa. Not that I say it's bad, it's just the cultures are different. So personally, that for me was unbelievable, bad thing to experience, but a warm thing, something that sits always here in my heart and my mind. And then obviously then managing the situations around that, you know, just the maturity of players like Billy Holland and everybody from oldest to the youngest guy, still playing a match with I think, 2 or 3 days after the funeral and getting a red card early in the match and still winning the match comfortably, you know, I think that also shows if you have one common cause and one common thing you play for, you can be really strong. And that game was definitely all out for Axel. And yeah, no, I don't want this to sound weird, but I was so proud to be part of what happened there, because it was also pure, man. It was also pure.
I don't think any Munster fan is going to forget that season afterwards, even in a hurry. It was amazing rugby. It was a tribute to Axel so brilliantly. How have you, like, what's your opinion on Munster's success thereafter? I mean, that season, your final season with Munster afterwards, I think it's a semi-final and it's a Pro 12 final. Obviously, they lost the Pro 14 final last week, and I think maybe if they get to a European Cup semi-final this year as well, they'd be doing pretty well. So have they progressed as quickly as you thought they might have done?
Yeah, look, when I was there myself and Jock, we were totally outplayed in the final of Pro 14. Or was it Pro 12 then?
Pro 12.
I mean, the Scarlets just... I've never coached a team which got 50 points, and that was probably the closest to getting 50. So it was one of the first times when I thought, oh, what's happening here? They just had our number on the day. But the one thing I remember, I was so embarrassed about the fans. But nobody was, obviously people were upset, but there was the people, it was the weirdest thing to see people, I've never experienced that, almost not sympathizing, but trying to encourage you, not slanting you. That was interesting. And then the semi-final against Saracens, you know, we always heard of Saracens here, and we know there's a lot of South Africans, but we never experienced that, and that machine that they were and how they operate, and that defensive system that they use, and the subs that are all world-class, and, you know, how they do things. And we were there in that game till, I think, minute 65, and then we experienced the typical Saracen. So that was a wake-up call for me. It certainly, I learned a lot there, but we obviously lost there. And I think Johan and Stephen and Larkham and all the guys, I think they're definitely always improving. But I think there's a little bit of a, even when we were there, there's a little bit of a mental block against the Leinsters. And I guess they'll find a way. You know, Johan's a great coach and his assistants are awesome. So, yeah, always watching the games and always rooting for them.
One last question, Johan, because I know we're right out of time. Would you consider coaching or even working in rugby in the Northern Hemisphere once again? I know your name's been linked with the England job over the last couple of weeks.
No, we will definitely do that. The plan was always, guys, and I know a lot of people think it wasn't, but my wife and my three daughters went over with me to Ireland and into Irish schools, English schools, Afrikaans-speaking girls. I even have them now in English classes here because they did pretty well there. They really quickly adapted, and they helped us a lot. We wanted to stay there till I'm 50, get the passport maybe, get my children to study on that side. So, but then, you know, we got the opportunity to get back earlier and get involved with the national team. I definitely, before I stop coaching, will definitely want to try and get back then. And, you know, the children is almost 18, so they're movable. So let's see what happens.
You'll be free is the key point there. You've been listening to Rassie Erasmus, who is joining online business leadership event Leaders Lounge. Leaders Lounge is an online interactive event designed for CEOs, senior management professionals, business executives, and those in wider leadership, startup, and coaching roles. Just to tell you again, the lineup, it is Rassie himself, Brian O'Driscoll, Lady Chanel McCoy, Joanna Reardon, and resident host Paul McGinley. And make sure to get on to leaderslouncelive.com for further information, and of course, to get tickets for the event, which takes place later this month. Rassie Erasmus, great catching up with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. And I'm following you guys as much as I can. Great job. Appreciate it.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.